From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamp, sitting in for Jim Fleming.
Maybe that's a good definition of a classic. Something that you come to as if you've already been there.
That's pop culture critic Greil Marcus, and that's our question today. What makes a classic? Take the American canon. Moby Dick, The Great Gatsby, The Catcher in the Rye. Now, shake it up, twist it around, and you get Patricia Highsmith. Her sinister psychological thrillers earned her a reputation as the dark lady of American letters.
And no one was stranger or more at an angle to what we understand conventional life to be than Patricia Highsmith.
And just when you thought it was safe to go back in the shower, it's the 50th anniversary of Alfred Hitchcock's classic shocker, Psycho.
My mother, what is the phrase? She isn't quite herself today.
But first, Greil Marcus is one of America's most admired pop culture critics, author of Mystery Train, A History of American Rock and Roll, and Lipstick Traces, A Secret History of the 20th Century. Now he's taken on the entire American canon. Together with Harvard professor Werner Solor, Marcus recently edited a doorstop-sized compendium of 200 essays called A New Literary History of America. Begins in 1507 with the very first appearance of the word America on a map, and it ends on November 4th, 2008, with the election of President Barack Obama. So what comes in between? Steve Paulson sat down with Greil Marcus to find out.
We felt that the only way to tell a true story of the American voice was to broaden the whole notion of what the literary meant to people discovering their voices, inventing their voices, and talking to each other. And it seems to me that, again, while The Scarlet Letter is here in an extraordinary essay by the novelist Parity Mukherjee, while The Sound and the Fury is here in an entry by Werner Solor, while there are three entries on Hemingway, while so many of the touchstones here are, I hope, looked at in a completely new way with a sense of freshness and discovery that is anything but a compendium or a summary of what's been said before. And that's what we ask people to do, to look at these touchstones of our history, these points of reference that everybody carries with them as if they hadn't been written about before, as if you're coming to this for the first time today. With all of that, the story is not there without theater. The story of Mark Twain is not there without his openness to all different other forms of communication, whether it was his disastrous investment in the linotype machine, his theatrical performances, his love of music, the way in which he brought the traveling theatrical troupes of his boyhood into his novels, and how that affected the way he wrote and the voices that he invented and discovered for his books.
Now, you could argue that the job of the literary scholar is to pick out what's best in our literary history rather than what had the biggest cultural impact, but that does not seem to be your primary concern here.
Oh, I wouldn't agree with that.
Oh, really?
I think that over and over, we looked for, whether it was a novel, whether it was a poem, whether it was a political speech, a Supreme Court decision, a sermon, a theatrical performance, a musical composition or recording, a moment of dialogue in a film or the invention of cinematography. I think over and over again we were looking for real flowerings of intuition, insight, discovery, an embrace of the possibilities both of the country as our great subject and of a new medium.
Most literary histories focus on works of art that are considered classics. And I guess I wonder if that notion of the classic has much meaning for you.
Of course it does, but in the sense of a book, a movie, a poem, political speech that you can return to again and again and again. And not only will it stay alive, not only will it continue to provoke you, but the context in which it seems to be embedded, and it might be a historical context, might be a cultural or intellectual context, a truly classic work will continually create new context for itself. It will elicit from the reader, the listener, the viewer, new thoughts, new responses. You don't go back to Moby Dick. You don't go back to Preston Sturges' films, Ernest Hemingway, Chuck Berry's early recordings. I don't think you go back to those things just to re-experience what you felt when you first encountered them. You go back because you know you haven't gotten to the bottom of the sound and the fury. You know that in Lincoln's second inaugural address, there are rhythms, there are cadences and that supersede the turns of phrase and will communicate to you like music. And the melodies will be different. The rhythms will be different each time you go back. To me, that's what a classic is.
Yeah. So you're saying a classic has a certain complexity in it that stands up to repeated readings or viewings or listenings. And I suppose the meaning changes depending on the current context that we're in today. I mean, we bring our own stuff to how we look back on that work of art.
Well, I think all classics, at least in the way I'm trying to talk about them, are in some essential way unfinished. They're open. They do not say, this is the way the world is, this is how it works, and that's all there is to it. They are alive to their own fragility and their own unlikeliness. You know, you cannot, when you look at something that we might call a classic, and it might be Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode, it might be Herman Melville's Moby Dick, you really can't imagine that the writer of either of those works said, okay, I know exactly what I'm doing here, and this is exactly the result it's going to have and the shape it's going to take. I don't think so. And I think that sense of openness and discovery is passed on to the reader or the listener, and one reacts in the same spirit in which a work is made.
Let me ask you about Moby Dick, because you wrote the essay on Moby Dick. Why do you think this book has proved to be so resonant in our culture?
There's so many different things. It's a great yarn. It's a great tall tale. It's a great action movie when you get to the end in particular. The last three chapters of Moby Dick, the chase, the first day, the chase, the second day. I mean, this is Die Hard.
And of course, it's also a story about obsession.
Right. Right now, I'm just floating on the surface. You know, I'm thinking of the humor. But then there are the characters. There are these archetypal characters, these allegorical characters, nevertheless come alive to us as people who we can picture in our minds, that we can imagine what we would do if we were in their presence or faced with their challenge. I mean, I think when I reread the book to write this entry for A New Literary History of America, the thing that most struck me, the way in which this book has entered our whole imagination, our shared national imagination, is this moment when Ishmael is going on to the Pequod while it's still docked to see if he can sign on as a seaman and what he's going to get paid. And one of the signing up officers of the ship says, have you ever seen Captain Ahab? Do you know anything about Captain Ahab? And Ishmael says, no, I've never heard of him. And it's kind of shocking because we've heard of him.
even if we've never read the book,
we know who Captain Ahab is. And it's kind of, what's the matter with you, man? You never heard of Captain Ahab? We're saying that, not the people in the book. And so that's when I realized, you know, that every time anybody goes to this book, including when a kid 10 years old, somebody 20 years old, somebody 50 years old who's reading and opening this book for the first time, in every way, to read this book for the first time is to reread it. The story is out there. It's already our story in references and poems and films and comic books. The story has been told again and again and again. And so you come back to this book, even if it's for the first time. Maybe that's a good definition of a classic. Hmm. Something that you come to as if you've already been there.
Grail Marcus is the co-editor, along with Werner Solor, of A New Literary History of America. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And how about you? What would you add to the list of American classics? You can send your suggestions and comments or questions to our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. And coming up, a look at the movie that taught America to love murder, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, and a classic inspired by a classic. Roseanne Cash's album, The List, was inspired by a gift from her father, Johnny Cash, his list of the 100 essential songs. We'll hear some of them later this hour. I'm Ann Strainchamps, in for Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Were you the first time you saw Psycho? I remember where I was. My very first night at college at a freshman mixer. Why school officials thought Psycho would be a good introduction to college life, I'll never know. But I don't think many of us took showers for a while. When it was originally released in 1960, negative reviews described Psycho as a blot on an honorable career and plainly a gimmick movie. But Psycho was a groundbreaking film that forever changed American cinema and America itself. That's the argument that film critic David Thompson makes in his new book, The Moment of Psycho, How Alfred Hitchcock Taught America to Love Murder. Thompson writes, among other things, about the making of that signature scene, one of the most famous in film history.
Everybody said the shower sequence, the killing, it really is a very nasty scene. How are we going to do that? How are you going to do it, Hitch? And in the script that he was sort of working towards, it, there was a very simple account of a knife coming into view and lopping the head off with one stroke. Now, but of course, that was not enough for Hitch. He said, oh, no.
That's over too fast.
Much too quickly. If you've got a good thing, take your time over it. Almost as if it was a sexual act, you know. And he said, we're going to need a whole week to shoot the sound sequence. It may only play for a minute on screen, but it may be the most intense minute there's ever been in American film, and we're going to take our time over it. Hitchcock was determined that the murder should be beautiful, and I think there you get to what he was really after. The outrage, the great outrage, is that the murder sequence should be one of the most beautiful sequences ever filmed. Because he was a man who believed, he thought, in pure film and telling a story through the visuals.
I guess I've always found it so violent it hasn't really struck me that it's beautiful. What's beautiful about that scene?
What is beautiful about it is the composition. It's the editing. It's the way in which the rhythm in the editing and the music builds and creates a whole. It's the way in which the audience is taken on an immense ride by the sequence. And it's the way in which they feel they have seen much, much more than they have. When you come out of the shower sequence, you think you've seen a knife going into a body time and again. Hitchcock took immense, meticulous pride in saying, you know, there's not a single shot where you see a knife point actually piercing skin. you think you've seen it, because I've created the impression of it. This is the kind of craft, the very cold-blooded craft, that he was obsessed with, where, I'm bound to say, I agree with you, I think he did sometimes lose touch with ordinary human feelings.
One of the most shocking things about that shower scene, especially for audiences at the time, is that the main character, Marion Crane, who's played by Janet Leigh, is killed off only 40 minutes into the film. Had this ever happened before?
No, I don't think as directly and as radically as that. Because, you know, when we watch films, we take in the information through a character. We identify with a character. We work out the story. We come to like them or dislike them. But we think we know where we are with them. And if you suddenly remove one of those characters, and certainly if one of those characters is played by the biggest star in the film, then the audience suddenly feels lost. And I can remember 40 minutes or so into the film, because that's really when it occurs, first time I saw it, you think, where do I attach myself now? Where do I find any sort of consolation or cover? With whom do I identify? Or am I really alone in this strange place where, for all I know, similar violence is going to be visited upon me any minute? And I can actually remember saying to myself, sort of saying to the film, oh, please, film, don't do that again just yet. You know, in a film like that, 40 minutes on, that if it's done something that terrible,
there's more coming.
You know there's more coming, but please give me a break. Let me try and calm down and gather myself. And that, of course, is when this strange character, Norman Bates, appears and cleans up and acts as if he's extremely shocked and horrified by the whole thing, which is more or less your response. So you cross over at that point, and going from Marion, you begin to identify with Norman. Now, of course, for all of those who know the film, and I think that's virtually everyone now, you know that what Hitchcock has done is just prepare a much greater trap for you.
How much of a part in that shower scene, well, how much of a part in the whole movie did Bernard Herrmann's musical score play?
I think it was vital. Hitch had worked with Herrmann quite a few times, and Herrmann was a really very, very accomplished musician. He had a career as a composer, quite apart from the stuff he did for the movies. And, you know, remember, he had done Citizen Kane and things like that, and would go on to do Taxi Driver at the end of his career. He's a man whose music we know. We have it in our heads. And there's a story that the crew on the film, many of whom had worked with Hitch often before, were joking during the shooting of the film, and they said, you know, Hitch, this is really going a bit far. You're really going over the taste line here. And I'm not sure that people are going to be drawn into it or whether they're going to start laughing at it, because it's pretty close to ridiculous sometimes. Well, one day near the end of the shooting, Herrmann came in, and he had composed some music, and he'd recorded it. And just to see how it went, they laid this little bit of music over one scene, and all of a sudden, everyone got it. The music lifts the film from that borderline of plausibility into a kind of Grand Guignol opera-like feeling. And the music is tremendously important to the film.
The subtitle of your book is How Alfred Hitchcock Taught America to Love Murder. Do you really think Psycho taught America to love murder, or do you think that was already the case and maybe Psycho just confirmed Americans' lust for violence?
You and I know what good citizens we are, and of course we disapprove of murder entirely and totally. However, let me remind you that by the late 1980s, there was a film, won the Best Picture Oscar, called The Silence of the Lambs, in which Hannibal Lecter, who really was a good deal more shocking than Norman Bates, Hannibal Lecter becomes an adorable, jokey figure. And when he says, I think I'm going to have him for dinner, talking about the doctor who has tormented him, everyone laughs at the end of the film. In the sequel, Hannibal, Lecter is nearly the heroine's lover. What I'm talking about is a process where we have allowed ourselves to indulge and play with murderers and other criminals, and that they have become something quite unlike the appalling villainous figures they are in real life. They have become very entertaining figures. And again, I think Psycho, don't forget that title. People didn't really know what the title meant in 60 because films had not dealt with disturbed personalities. It was part of the code that you were not really supposed to have unbalanced, mentally ill characters because you might come close to making fun of them. No one really wanted to do that. But what it meant was that madness was played for humor in films rather more than as a serious thing. Psycho introduces the disturbed personality as a central character, and that character is all over the place today.
One of the most remarkable things about Psycho, I think, is that it's so undated. In fact, Malcolm Jones recently wrote in Newsweek that Psycho not only doesn't seem dated, it feels almost contemporary, like a kind of Dorian Gray movie. You know, we get older, but it doesn't. What do you think of that idea?
I agree totally. It was really the reason why I picked this film, because the publisher had said, pick a film that you think changed the movies, but, you know, that is still a film that people can see today, and they get it. And horror, and obviously this is a horror film, horror dates very quickly. If you remember, between the first and the second release of The Exorcist, we became so much hipper about these kind of things. And The Exorcist became much more of a funny film, not nearly as frightening. Psycho, I think, for anyone who's seeing it for the first time, is still a test. It's still a very frightening film. And that's because Hitchcock was a master. Whether we call him a great artist or a great entertainer, I don't think it really matters. Hitchcock could sit you down with a film and give you one of the most intense experiences of your life.
David Thompson is the author of The Moment of Psycho, How Alfred Hitchcock Taught America to Love Murder. We've talked about film classics and literary classics, now the country music canon. Back in 1973, country music legend Johnny Cash gave his daughter Roseanne a list of the 100 songs he considered essential. In 2009, Roseanne Cash released an album inspired by that list. Now, music critic Michael Streisguth takes us behind the scenes in his book, Always Been There, Roseanne Cash, The List, and the Spirit of Southern Music. Streisguth is an authority on Johnny Cash, and as he told Steve Paulson,
Roseanne told me that her father was quite concerned when they would talk about country music and the canon, if you will, that she just didn't have much knowledge at all. And that was really the impetus for him to disappear in a part of the bus and scroll down these 100 songs.
These were the 100 songs he called the essential country songs, which I suppose he might have called the essential American songs.
Yes, and from what Roseanne tells me, Cash did draw from gospel and the blues and folk in compiling this list. So it just wasn't Jimmy Rogers and Hank Williams and Lefty Frizzell. It was Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan as well.
But you write that once she got interested in this project, she couldn't find the list. this list of the 100 essential songs that her father put together. And here she was hunting through her house and didn't know where it had gone.
You know, I was really surprised that Roseanne gave me so much access in writing this book. And part of that access meant going with her into the attic while she sifted through files and scrapbooks and behind paintings and in guitar cases looking for this list. She talked about that quite philosophically because while I was with her, the list never turned up. And she was forced to
recreate the list from her memory of the list. And she said it really became a richer experience because if she had had the actual list, she would have said, okay, well, I'll do this one, this one, this one. But in trying to reconstruct the list, she was really forced to try to get inside her father's head and think about what he was thinking when he compiled this list. And for her, she said, it became a much richer experience, a much more meaningful interaction with her father's legacy.
But it also suggests a complicated relationship that Roseanne Cash must have had with her father that in some ways she didn't want to just be under his thumb. I mean, you know, she hid it somewhere because she didn't – it would seem she didn't want to just – as she was sort of coming into her own as a singer-songwriter, she didn't want to just do what he told her to do.
Well, I think you said that. I mean, that's one of the major themes running through Roseanne Cash's career, this idea of finding one's own place away from one's parents. It's really what we all experience.
But when your father is Johnny Cash, that ups it several notches.
Well, that's the twist. The shadow spans much farther. She has much more work to do to get out from under his gnarly oak tree. I think putting away the list was part of separating herself from her father. I mean, this wasn't the only aspect of this separation. She often refused his requests to perform with him. As she began to develop her own solo career, she pulled her songs out of his publishing company. She would tell the press that, yeah, he's my dad and he gives me advice and sometimes I take it and sometimes I don't. I think coming back to the list has been a way of coming back to her father.
Hmm. Well, tell me about some of the songs on the list, which is the title of her album. Are there any in particular that really stand out to you?
Well, I think Miss the Mississippi and You is actually the first track on the album. It's a song that was popularized by Jimmy Rogers.
I'm growing tired of the big city lights. Tired of the glamour and tired of the sights. And all of my dreams I am roaming once more. Back to my home on the old river shore. Nothing seems to cheer me under heaven's dome. Miss the Mississippi and you.
I was struck one day during this process that she went through. We were getting ready to go to the studio, and she knew she was to record the song that day. She ran upstairs to her computer and logged onto the internet and found the lyrics to the song on Bob Dylan's website, of all places. And I was really struck by that ballad change just at that moment. I mean, here, in a way, communicating through modern technology and through the embodiment of Bob Dylan on the internet, was the grandfather of country music, Jimmy Rogers, and a granddaughter.
Miss the Mississippi and you.
One is her version of the Patsy Cline classic, She's Got You. What did she do with that song?
At first, she harked back to her very intense interest in Patsy Cline. I think she admires Patsy Cline's attitude. I mean, Patsy Cline, as far as we know, didn't take any guff from anybody. sang the songs she wanted to sing, very much succeeded in what was most definitely a man's world in Nashville in the late 1950s and the 1960s. Actually, Johnny Cash, her father, brought Patsy Cline to their home back in the early 60s. Patsy would tour with Johnny occasionally. And at this particular time, she was pretty bruised and beaten up as a result of a conflict with a male, somebody she was with. And she, in essence, came back to the house to recuperate. And Roseanne's mother told her about Patsy being at their home, and she has no recollection of that, but she really strives to try to remember something, to try to link to that moment in some ethereal way. And I think her recording of She's Got You is perhaps an effort to link back to that elusive period of time when she was around Patsy Cline.
I've got your memory, or has it got me? I really don't know, but I know it won't let me be. I've got your class ring that proved you cared, and it still
I think another complication, perhaps, of Roseanne Cash's relationship with her father, Johnny, is that Johnny left her mother. He left Vivian to go off with another woman, the woman who later became his wife, June Carter Cash. Did Roseanne hold that against her father?
Well, you know, she would say that, in fact, the wedge that was driven between her and her father and her mother and her father was drug use, and that, in fact, he became unavailable long before he became unavailable because of June Carter. I would have thought that there would be some more resentment there. For example, it was quite surprising to me that when she graduated from high school, she fled to Nashville. I thought, well, you're fleeing to this man who abandoned your family. It turns out there was difficulty in her relationship with her mother as well. She felt very judged by her mother, smothered by her mother. Interestingly enough, in the early 70s there, when she got the list from her father, she felt a freedom in Nashville. And she felt that it was very much a time of their reacquaintance.
10 years ago, on a cold, dark night, there was someone killed neath the town hall light. There were few at the scene, but they all did agree that the slayer who ran looked a lot like me.
Do you think she came to reconcile with her father and her father's legacy to some degree by working on this album, The List?
I think so. And that was really one of the points of curiosity wrapped around this project. I was interested in knowing how this album project was affecting her relationship with her father and her father's legacy. And in fact, one moment up there in that attic where the list was hiding somewhere, you know, I asked her that. Where does she find her father in all of this? And she said, you know, with my father gone now, it's really the music that helps me link to him. That's all I have to allow me to bond with him anymore. And I thought that was quite poignant, quite touching, actually.
Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me.
Now, I'm curious, did the experience of working on this book change the way you think about the history of Southern music or what makes a classic song?
I thought a lot about the tragedy, I suppose, the poverty that is our country's snubbing of our own tradition. We don't hark back enough to the great songwriters and songs and song traditions. And I think the album really drove home for me this importance of bringing the songs to new generations, that they are living, breathing things. They're not museum pieces. They still speak to the human experience, to the American experience. The list, I think, is valuable because of that.
So in some ways, classic songs need to always be reinterpreted by new artists.
Well, that's what makes them classic songs. It's the songs that aren't reinterpreted that are so connected to the original artist that they can't be reinterpreted, that perhaps in the end are wanting, that are not classics.
The big gate wheeler rolling down the track means your true love and mama ain't a coming back. I'm moving on. I'll soon be gone. You were flying too high for my little sky, so I'm moving on.
That's Roseanne Cash. We heard Michael Streisguth talking with Steve Paulson. Streisguth is an authority on The Man in Black, Johnny Cash. He and Steve were talking about his most recent book, Always Been There, Roseanne Cash, The List, and the Spirit of Southern Music. So how do you define a classic? Do you have any favorite classic songs of your own? You can send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, The Secret Life and Serious Art of Patricia Highsmith. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Fantasies about killings or anything like that yourself?
No, not of any people, no. I may have disliked some people, but it's not quite the same thing. But I think I was 9 or 10. I had a feeling I would die when I fell asleep, and I was afraid of that. And I used to, it took me ages to get to sleep. I remember many a time I was up, awake until 2, and I had the feeling I would stop breathing. So I used to take water and snuff it up my nose a bit as if that would keep me awake somehow. That must have gone on several weeks, months even. But fear of death is not quite the same thing.
That's the voice of Patricia Highsmith. Now, even if you've never read her novels or short stories, even if you've never heard of her, you still may be familiar with Patricia Highsmith's dark and disturbing worldview. Alfred Hitchcock's classic film Strangers on a Train was based on her first novel. The 1999 critically acclaimed film The Talented Mr. Ripley was also adapted from a Highsmith novel. Still, she's hardly a household name. Biographer Joan Schenker thinks Patricia Highsmith has languished in obscurity far too long and deserves to be recognized as the author of one of the great American novels. Schenker's new biography is called The Talented Miss Highsmith, The Secret Life and Serious Art of Patricia Highsmith.
One of the interesting things about biography is that it's a mostly unexplored form. There are so many things that can be done with it, just as there are so many things that can be done with life. And when you have a life like Patricia Highsmith's, a woman to whom extremity was just the normal condition of living, you have to find a form that can hold the shape of her life properly. And so I decided to structure this book according to her obsessions. She was an obsessional writer. She was an obsessional lover. She was an obsessional observer. It seemed to be a good idea, and in fact, it's worked out very well.
I read one story in which you were quoted as saying that if Patricia Highsmith had not become a writer, she would have become a murderer. Do you really believe that?
What I believe is that she had all the equipment for homicide. She had the sudden flares of rage. She dreamt about murder all the time. But we also have to remember that she was an American raised in the Calvinist tradition. So nothing breaks your homicidal impulses like a good dose of childhood Calvinism. I think that, like most intense creators, she used her strongest feelings and channeled them into her art. So we can't ever say that she would have killed someone, since she didn't do it, but she did write about murder all the time.
That reminds me partly of just one of the lists you found, and she was an obsessive list maker. This one was titled, Little Crimes for Little Tots.
Oh, isn't that lovely? Yes. Sitting in her house by the Luang Canal, into which she had Tom Ripley throw so many of his objects of murder and retrievals from his murders in France, she, one day, thinking about children, as she often did, decided to make a list of some of the ways in which children could murder their parents. Now, it's a formal, objective little list. You know, you can saw through supports in an attic. You can put a little poison in the gin bottle. You can mix up your parents' prescription medications. But since Highsmith was the most personal of writers, I think we have to assume that it was not just any little child murdering her parents. This was something that Patricia Highsmith had thought about again and again. From the age of 8, she said, she had obsessive thoughts about murdering her stepfather. She did not do so, but when he finally died of Parkinson's disease, the first thing she did was order up his autopsy so she could see just exactly how. And she considered this a normal thing to do.
How did Patricia translate all these personal hatreds and grievances into her work, into her writing?
Well, she is our most personal novelist. Once you get to know her life, and that's one of the great uses of biography, which, by the way, is a real literary art form, but it also illuminates other art forms. Once you get to know her life, you can see every bit of it in her work. But like Emily Dickinson, she decided to tell the truth in a slanted way. So every feeling she ever had turns up mostly in her male protagonists. From an early age, she decided that she was a boy in the body of a girl, and I don't think she was wrong. So every impulse she ever had was expressed, and lucky for us, in art rather than in life. So you can pretty much trace her development through her novels.
Now, Patricia Highsmith also had a very tumultuous love life, mostly, though not exclusively, with other women. She was an aggressive seducer. She sometimes dated as many as 3 women at the same time.
I once caught her with 5.
Oh.
Yeah, it's perfectly true. And her complexity and her ability to partition herself off, which is a uniquely obsessional trait, allowed her to carry on. The kind of adorable thing about her is that she fell in love every day of her life. Love was a huge element of her work, and many of those women became muses for her. In fact, the worse her relationship with a woman was, the better she wrote. She mined every relationship she had for her work. She was, you know, to the ends of her fingertips, a real artist, which means that she used people.
We should talk some about her most famous book, The Talented Mr. Ripley, published in 1955. Story of Tom Ripley, in some ways kind of anti-hero, who represented an entirely new kind of character in crime fiction.
Yeah, that's one of her great, great innovations. Highsmith, like everyone else in mid-century America, was obsessed by the American dream, the idea that you can always do better, that if you just work hard in the great country of the plains, you can make something of yourself. Only she just, because she saw everything from through the mirror, she saw everything in reverse, she decided it would be a wonderful idea to create a hero, and she always called him a criminal hero, off the ends of her own nerves. Someone who began as a kind of grifter. He started as a slight blackmailer and really turned into a major murderer. And not only did he murder, but he murdered for profit. And as he murders, he becomes more attractive. He dresses better. He's able to change places with a wealthy young man that he murdered. The book also, by the way, is one of the best critiques of capitalism I've ever read. And it was written by a major capitalist. Highsmith loved money and worked very hard for it. I believe that the talented Mr. Ripley certainly deserves to be considered as one of the great American novels. And I slowly think that it is becoming that considered.
Do you think Highsmith considered herself a crime novelist? Or do you think she saw herself more as a novelist who just happened to write about criminals and sociopaths?
That's right. She never, ever considered herself a genre writer. And she's been corralled into this genre because people don't know how to identify her or explain her. The talented Mr. Ripley and also Strangers on a Train appeared in lines of novels which were classified as suspense books. And she did write a short book about the plotting and writing of suspense novels. But she starts that book telling you that Dostoevsky could also be considered a suspense writer. That's the class she thought of herself in. She thought of herself as an artist making novels and fictions. No, the American tendency for labeling has helped her economically and really hampered her artistically. In Europe, where she's far more famous than she is here, she was considered to be on a par with Kafka and Dostoevsky, and there's a lot of reason for that.
Why do you think she's not better known here in this country? Do you think it's that her work was just too unusual, too disturbing?
She is deeply disturbing. If you read her closely, no novelist I have ever encountered is more likely to bite the hand of someone who buys her. I think that people didn't know what to do with her. And also she was living in Europe, and it's hard to stretch your reputation that far. But in fact, she's a quintessentially American novelist, and that business about her not being known here is rapidly being remedied. One of the things that biography can do is shine the lamp on the work of the subject. And I see with great delight that her books are selling very well now.
You said her work is extremely disturbing. What's so disturbing about it?
Well, let's look at this. Every impulse that her major characters have are, one, antisocial, two, anti-life, three, they challenge all gender assignations. For instance, the criminal hero of Deep Water allows his wife to have affairs. He only wishes the men she picked were of a higher quality so that he could talk to them. He happily dons a, and this is in, you know, early 1960s, he happily dons an apron, vacuums the house, serves the food and cooks it, takes care of the child. Meanwhile, his wife is having the life of a Don Juan, out seducing men. So she does a lot of reversals. As I said, she took everything off the ends of her own nerves, and no one was stranger or more at an angle to what we understand conventional life to be than Patricia Highsmith. So yes, they are disturbing novels. Oh, excuse me. Did I mention that this hero also murders two of his wife's lovers? So while he's, you know, in between cooking dinner and entertaining the rest of them. So, yeah, she is disturbing.
Well, that's one of the things I've always found so disturbing about reading her is she sucks you into liking the main character, the protagonist, and then this person who you partly come to identify with does something just appalling. I mean, absolutely reprehensible. And suddenly you're inside the mind of somebody you loathe.
That's right. I actually had the same experience working on Highsmith myself. I spent quite a bit of time just rigid with horror at mostly her crimes of the heart. And then I had the same experience that people who read her novels deeply have. I had to get larger than my own prejudices in order to understand her. She forced me into a revision of thinking that's probably never happened to me. And I'm very grateful to her for it, by the way.
I keep thinking about a journal entry you found. She wrote it, she was young, 26 years old, New Year's Eve, 1947. And she wrote this 2:30 a.m. entry in her journal that reads, "My New Year's Eve toast to all the devils, lusts, passions, greeds, envies, loves, hates, strange desires, enemies ghostly and real, the armies of memories with which I do battle, may they never give me peace."
Well, she knew what the wellsprings of her art were, and she worked best, and frankly, most writers do, off the things which are deeply disturbing to them. She knew that she was haunted. She was haunted from birth on. She remembers her birth as being something that shouldn't have happened, partly, I suppose, because of the story her mother told her about swallowing turpentine in the hopes of aborting this child. By the way, she loved the smell of turpentine for the rest of her life, which just shows you how perverse she was. Highsmith was not wired the way most people are. And that is what is so interesting about her. She was deeply different. And we need to know much more about people who are deeply different.
Joan Shenkar's book about the Dark Lady of American Letters is called The Talented Miss Highsmith, The Secret Life and Serious Art of Patricia Highsmith. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps, sitting in for Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 131A, Classics. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by that modern classic, Doug Gordon, with help from Jim Fleming, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Thanks this week to special guest engineer Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and our technical director, that dark lady of the audio console, is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.